They'll start for AFC Market Bosworth. Getting 11 players on the pitch is difficult in amateur football.
In any team sport like that. And to play with just 7 players on the pitch.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Thank you very much for that update, Anne. Loads of you getting in touch with your sporting events in your back garden.
Yeah, speaking of being impressed.
Yeah. We shall get through some of those very, very shortly. Right, it is time for news and sport now. Just coming around to 5 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
The headlines then at 5 o'clock on Drive. Lebanon says more than 270 people, including 21 children, have been killed and more than 1,000 injured in heavy Israeli bombardment in the south of the country. The Israeli military said it had targeted 800 Hezbollah positions. Our correspondent Hugo Bachega is in Beirut.
We're talking about the deadliest day in Lebanon since the beginning of this conflict, the most intense airstrikes by Israel. Southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah is located, in the eastern Bekaa Valley, which is another Hezbollah stronghold. But for the first time, the north of the country has been hit.
We'll have an update on that story in this hour of the programme. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has promised to make hard but fair choices with a relentless focus on the priorities of the British people. Speaking to the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, she also insisted there'd be no return to austerity in next month's budget. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth was watching.
Rachel Reeves kept talking about the Britain that Labour wanted to build. She talked about getting shovels in the ground and cranes in the sky, the need for jobs and the need for investment. But despite all of that, what a lot of people are saying is the devil will be in the detail, because of course we've got the budget on the horizon on October the 30th, when we will hear the specific details of Rachel Reeves's plans.
Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise. The Royal College of Nursing said a record number of its members voted on the deal and two-thirds were against it. The Culture Secretary is Lisa Nandy.
We'll get round the table, we'll talk to the nurses, but obviously we were elected to fix the foundations. We've got a £22 billion black hole this year alone. We've got to make some difficult choices, but already the Chancellor has announced an above-inflation pay rise for all public sector workers, including nurses.
There's been flash flooding in parts of central and southern England after more than a month's worth of rain fell in 24 hours. There are amber and yellow weather warnings for rain for large areas of England and parts of Wales up until midnight. Keith Garwood's home in Bedfordshire has been affected.
When I got up this morning, the back garden was partially flooded. Now it's completely flooded and it must be under about 8 or 9 inches of water. It's never been this bad since we've lived here in 2013.
Yeah, it's affected a lot of people today, a lot of traffic issues as well. Orna will be here in just a moment to get you updated on that. And two Russian cosmonauts have landed back on Earth after a record-breaking stay aboard the International Space Station. They spent 374 days there, the longest ever continuous stint. And their first question on returning to Earth was, who won Celebrity MasterChef? No, it wasn't. But they'll be catching up on all everything they've missed over 374 days.
Has Strictly started yet?
Yeah, yeah. Who's in Strictly? Delith.
Hello.
Hello.
I certainly
have. You got the sport?
I have,
that's
yes. Hello once again. The Friedkin Group say they look forward to providing stability to Everton and sharing their vision for the future after agreeing to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club. The group, led by the American billionaire Dan Friedkin, had entered a period of exclusivity to negotiate a possible purchase back in June before talks then fell through in July. But the deal has now been signed and is subject to Premier League approval. Meanwhile, Leeds United have just announced plans to modernise and improve Ellen Road. Part of their proposal is to increase capacity from just over 37,500 to around 53,000. And Glamorgan have won their second One Day Cup title in 4 years after beating Somerset by 15 runs in the final at Trent Bridge. Glamorgan made 186 for 7 in their shortened 20 overs thanks to an unbeaten 63 from Sam Northeast. Somerset managed just 171 for 6 in reply.
A look at your travel, and there's a lot of localised flooding out there. It's also affecting many rail branch lines, so it's worth checking ahead if you're using the rail, and also the tubes in London, part suspensions, only on a couple of lines though. Then we've got the M58 on Merseyside heading east from Switch Island, heading towards Junction 1 at Kirby. Barrier repairs going on, so the road is blocked. The M8 and Glasgow queues heading into Glasgow. It's eastbound at 23 Ibrox, but the queue starts at 26 Hillington. It's only a broken down van in one lane though. And the M56, so westbound queues at 6 Hailforth Seasons roundabout. A breakdown blocking one of the lanes there. The M5 was closed in Gloucestershire northbound at 13 Stroud. Two lanes are still closed. The lorry broke down there and severe delays backing up its recovery going on there. Also, the A38 is really congested. People diverting using that. You've got the M1 northbound with the fallen tree taking up two lanes at Milton Keynes, 14 to 15, heading up to Northampton. That's the M1 northbound, 14 to 15. A1M, repairs going on at 6, well in one lane down, and the M2, so barrier repairs there. Again, it was an accident which happened this morning, so westbound queues at Chatham at Junction 3, and the South End arterial road, a jackknife lorry blocking the road at Dunton Junction. Orna Merchant to 5 Live Travel.
Cheers, Orna. Thank you very much indeed. Loads to get through in this hour of the programme. We will be in Jerusalem for the latest on the latest attacks on Lebanon by the Israelis. The health ministry in Lebanon, as you heard in the news there, saying 270 people have died today. It does seem to be somewhat something of an escalation, and residents in southern Lebanon say they've received phone messages from the Israelis warning them to leave places that are frequented by Hezbollah. So we'll keep you updated on that as we go along.
Yeah, as you've just been hearing in the sport as well with Dalith, we will be talking about the new owners of Everton. That's at about 5:30. And I'd be interested to hear your questions on that too. 850-58. And we will be hearing a really interesting story about a visually impaired football fan and his Labrador, his guide dog, that have become the first man and dog to visit every single Scottish League stadium. All 42 of them. That just before 6 o'clock.
Yeah. Thank you for all your texts to the show as well about various sporting events in your back garden. Sarah in London says, my sister and I created the Horse of the Year show in our garden. We had bamboo canes as show jumps and our pond was the water jump.
Can I just say that's the second time that bamboo canes have been mentioned.
It's the only use for them.
Well, I mean, I remember having bamboo canes whenever I was a child. Where did they go? Is that not a thing
anymore? That's a good point.
Yeah. What's happened to all the bamboo canes?
Yeah. What's going on?
Just on that, Sarah in London, thank you very much for that. She doesn't say whether they used horses or just their own legs, so I don't know about that.
Oh, these are brilliant. My two brothers, Danny and Jamie, and I designed a speedway track around the garden. The first corner was the pampas grass. The second, the willow tree, destroyed the lawn. But brilliant racing with all our mates. I love it. Mum made the tinfoil trophies. Yeah. Football cards and the wheels raced all day.
This is something I would have done as a parent. Janet says, when I was a child, we had a swing in our back garden. My dad went mad. He didn't want the grass being worn away by us dragging our feet.
Yeah.
That's something. I once hid the polystyrene snow from a Bratz doll's house. I got my daughter the Christmas chalet. She still brings it up, but I hid all the polythene balls that were supposed to come out of the chimney. Who'd do that? Who'd set them off? Anyway, so my dad, instead of lifting the seat, he just concreted the grass.
Problematic.
Yeah, it got rid of the grass anyway. So thank you very much for that. When have you created we've got loads to get through. When have you created a sporting arena in your back garden? 850-58. We got one.
It was the end of that text that you didn't get to there. What he saved on grass seed, he spent on plasters and a trip for her to A&E.
There we go, yeah.
See,
I tried to keep it a happy ending. we're talking about that and what's happened to all the bamboo canes in the world? You've not seen one picture.
Someone's going to have the answer to that, aren't they? Somebody will know.
850-58 or WhatsAppers 08085. Surely those cosmonauts, says Steve, asked who won Fact of the Day. The fact is, we can't remember who won Fact of the Day last season, and none of the commentators are interested enough to remember.
We're still doing it this season.
We are.
It's still going on.
Still. Yes, it's still going on, Delith.
I'll have to listen back on BBC Sound.
If you listened on a Friday, you might have known that. I'll just leave that there.
Yeah. Leave that one hanging.
Okay, it is 8:05.
Matt Shawley.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. It was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, so just say the culture media as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley.
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Holly and Tony. It is 9 minutes past five, and to the backdrop of rise over Labour donations, Sue Gray, cuts to winter fuel payments, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has made her first ever conference speech since taking over the country's finances. And she told the party there would be hard but fair choices ahead to sort out the economy. And she insisted she won't follow what the coalition government did in 2010.
Next month, I will deliver the first budget of this Labour government. The first Labour budget in 14 years. And because I know, how much damage has been done in those 14 years, let me say one thing straight up. There will be no return to austerity. Conservative austerity was a destructive choice for our public services and for investment and growth too. Yes, we must deal with the Tory legacy, and that means tough decisions. But I won't let that dim our ambition for Britain. So it will be a budget with real ambition, a budget to fix the foundations, a budget to deliver the change that we promised, a budget to rebuild Britain.
Well, the Chancellor's speech was interrupted at one point by a heckler protesting about arms sales to Israel. But as you'd expect, in the hall itself, apart from that one heckler, the speech got a really good reception. Rachel Reeves defended the government's decision to cut the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners.
I know that not everyone in this hall or in the country will agree with every decision that I make. But I will not duck those decisions. Not for political expediency, not for personal advantage. Faced with that £22 billion black hole that the Conservatives left this year, and with a triple lock ensuring that the state pension will rise by an estimated £1,700 over the course of this Parliament, I judged it the right decision in the circumstances that we inherited.
Well, actually, a vote on those plans to cut winter fuel payments at the Labour Party conference has been delayed now. So from today, it looks like it might happen on Wednesday now, when I suppose many delegates will have already left. It would have been a non-binding vote, but unions aren't happy. Sharon Graham is the leader of Unite.
They're trying to move it. I think after the lights have gone out on Wednesday at some point. And the problem here is it's tin-eared. This is an issue that people want to come to the floor. This motion was ruled out. It's now got ruled back in. And it's now looks like it's been moved to Wednesday when Keir's not here. When the country is talking about winter fuel and what you're doing to pensioners and you want to shut down a debate at your own conference, that isn't a good look.
Well, in terms of substance, we'll learn a lot more in Rachel Reeves' first budget next month. She did mention setting up the post of COVID corruption minister to look at contracts handed out during the pandemic. And she mentioned as well the launch of free breakfast clubs in hundreds of schools. That's from April next year.
Yeah, we are still waiting for some meat on the bones, I suppose, for that budget. Tom Hamilton is a former Labour policy advisor and he is at the conference in Liverpool. Afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
Oh, good evening, I think I should say at this point. Look,
yeah, maybe.
Tom, I'm interested. We talked so much in the build up to Labour becoming the government about change. You know, that was the slogan as such. And now they've added a word into it. Change begins. And I'm just going to read you a text here from Matt in Stoke who says, can you please ask what on earth this change is they waffle on about? So what is it? Have you got more of a sense of that now after today?
Well, I think we did get the start of that from Rachel Reeves today. I think part of it's a slight problem she's got in terms of the timing is that this conference is happening before the budget and there's a lot that she can't say and won't say until then. But I think we did get, the start of what she's talking about in terms of change. I think what Labour is doing in general and what Rachel is doing, especially in particular as Chancellor, is there's an argument that's got three parts to it, really. One is, the first part is, we've inherited a mess that, we already knew the country was in a state. That's why we got elected, but we're in an even bigger mess than we thought. The second point is that as a direct result of that, we've had to make some difficult decisions that a lot of people don't like and that we don't like either, says Labour, says Rachel. No one wanted to cut winter fuel allowance. There are other things that she's done that she hasn't liked and that are quite unpopular. And then the third point is, but as a result of that, we are fixing the foundations of the economy and we're able to make decisions in the longer term that will bring growth and that will make make Britain stronger and better. And that we heard a lot of that in relation to infrastructure investment in particular. And some of the detail of that is yet to come. The flesh, as you say, needs to be put on the bones. But there's some quite interesting sort of straws in the wind, I think, about things that she might say in future in terms of investment by talking about, you know, the need to make sure that the Treasury doesn't just count the cost of investment, but also looks at the benefits of investment. Is it the suggestion that some of the ways in which that accounting is done might change in ways that might make it slightly easier for those investment decisions to be made?
Yeah, there were obviously, as you mentioned, there were key things that the Chancellor wanted to get across, including how much that they had inherited. We've heard that message time and time again at this point. She was also very keen to insist that there would be no return to austerity. It was something she was talking about in interviews early this morning as well. She really wanted to hit that home. But at the same time, in that speech, you do get a sense that there are cuts coming. You know, she's talking about things being steeper and harder and tougher on things like tax and welfare and spending. Should we then be bracing ourselves for cuts?
Well, I think there's a difference between saying that some taxes may change, and look, I don't have any more than you do the details of what that might look like, but they've clearly been preparing the ground for some tax rises, although ruling out that tax rises on the sort of the big taxes that we all pay, VAT, income tax and national insurance. I think they've been at pains to talk about, while there might be, you know, there will be changes overall in spending, they've talked about not only in general terms about no return to austerity, but also saying that there aren't going to be cuts in departmental budgets. Now, quite what that means in terms of the overall profile of spending, we'll have to wait and see. Some things, you know, that we might want to, you know, that any of us might want to see more spending on may or may not happen. But I think the overall message that that this is not a government that's committed to austerity, and that you know, we're going to see a little bit more spending in future than we've seen over the last decade or so. I think that's starting to come across, but we're going to have to wait for the detail of that.
This discussion over the winter fuel payments is not going away, Tom. And then delaying this, you know, this vote now, they can't really avoid it. And do you understand what the unions are saying? They're not happy. Many delegates will have left, but by the time this takes place on Wednesday, it's in terms of messaging, it's not great.
Well, I think some delegates will have left by the time the vote happens. That isn't going to change the substance of the result of the vote, which I would expect. I mean, like, I don't have any great insight to this, but I don't expect the leadership to win that vote necessarily. I think the interesting point here is that now that the decision's been made about winter fuel allowance, they've been very clear they're not going to U-turn on it. If, you know, that is to save £1.4 billion. If you are going to put £1.4 billion somewhere into the welfare system now, you wouldn't put it there. That's not where that money should go, because, you know, the argument for doing it was that a lot of that money went to people who didn't need it. There are a lot of people across the welfare system who could do with more support. And if I was going to put £1.4 billion in somewhere, I mean, that is one of the last places I put it, quite frankly.
We talked, you know, about trying to be positive. And when we spoke to, or we had any kind of phone-ins on this, particularly from Labour supporters themselves, they did want a sense of positivity. Now, there has been an awful lot of doom and gloom since Labour came into power. Do you think the Chancellor has done enough today to allay those fears?
Well, I think she's put a marker down that this isn't just, you know, this isn't a government of austerity. It's not a government that is all about talking about how terrible the inheritance is, but nevertheless, it's a government that's got a terrible inheritance, right? You know, the best answer to the question,
but how long can that be the excuse for?
Well, it can be the excuse for a very long time because it's true, right? But she obviously needs to, and I don't think there's any controversy about this within the Labour Party, they're going to have to announce some positive things. We've seen some sort of some early steps on those announcements in relation to school breakfast clubs today, which is, you know, they're going to pilot it before they roll it out fully, but we've seen the start of that. There are changes to planning laws are going to make a real difference to the amount of house building and other infrastructure building that can happen in this country. But I don't think there's any shame at all in this government saying for quite a long time, as previous governments said about their predecessors, that the reason they're taking some of the decisions they're taking is because of the inheritance that they were left. You know, George Osborne didn't shut up about the financial crisis in like October, November 2010. And I don't expect Rachel Reeves to stop talking about Liz Truss's mini budget tomorrow. I expect that to be part of the government's narrative going forward. And I don't see why it shouldn't be, because it is part of the context in which, you know, it's the reason why one of the reasons Labour got elected is that the last government was perceived by most people to have got things wrong.
And that surely is part of your mandate and everything that you discussed before. And absolutely, you know, in those early days, you want to set that out. But when we are speaking to people and when people are contacting us, the mood is that they're kind of fed up of hearing that at this point.
Yeah, well, you've got to say things until people think they're fed up of hearing about it, because they haven't heard it till they're fed up of hearing it. It's just a general rule of comms. I think you're absolutely right. There is going to have to be more positivity going forward, and I don't think anyone in the Labour leadership disagrees with that. I'd expect to hear a lot more positivity coming out of Keir Starmer tomorrow, but also more positivity coming out of ministers in the next months and the next years. This is the very early days of a government. They're setting the context in which they're operating. There will be, you know, good things to come, but the good things don't come straight away. So, of course, any government has to give a sense of hope, but it also has to give a sense of realism.
Obviously, too, the other issue that has come up and hasn't, again, it came up this afternoon when Scotland Secretary Ian Murray and the Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawar, they were asked questions about the gifts and the hospitality. Mm-hmm. It continues to cast a shadow over this conference.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's pretty clear from the fact that ministers have said that they're not going to accept these gifts going forward, that they recognise that it was a mistake to do it in the way that they did. So, look, it's happened. They're not going to do it again. Move on is basically where they want to be. It is up to the public and the media how quickly they do move on. And, you know, no government can make the media and the public think about things that the media and the public don't want to think about. But I think, you know, clearly the headlines leading into this conference haven't been great. Changes have been made to the way things are handled. And I think they will want to be able to move on from that.
Tom Hamilton, former Labour policy advisor, thanks for your time on that this afternoon. It's wishful thinking from me. It is 21 minutes past five.
Yeah, still loads to come on Drive. Lebanon's health minister says an intense Israeli bombardment has now killed more than 270 people and injured more than 1,000. That makes it the deadliest day in nearly a year of conflict across Israel's northern border. The Israeli army says it's struck about 800 Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Israel says it's broadening its strikes and had earlier called on civilians in southern Lebanon to leave the areas that they're targeting. The IDF says it's conducted a targeted strike in Beirut. Anyway, we'll be picking through that and getting to the nub of it all with our correspondent Daniel De Simone in Jerusalem in the next half an hour.
Yeah, and we'll be speaking to football finance expert Kieran Maguire after 5:30. Always has great insight into these issues about Everton's new owners. 85058 if you do have any questions, particularly from Everton fans.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, a 14-year-old boy caught up in the Southport riots has avoided punishment after police and prosecutors decided that his parents' anger was enough. The telling off he received after being marched to a police station was, in their words, more effective than taking him through the courts. That's according to the Director of Public Prosecutions. That's a gent called Stephen Parkinson. He says, on the flip side, he's come across families who thought joining in with rioting was what he calls a day out. Let's chat to Michael Conroy. He was a secondary school teacher for over 15 years. Michael's company now trains staff working with boys and young men about being safe and creating violence-free relationships and communities. Michael, hello.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me. You're
welcome. This will have taken a lot of people by surprise, I guess, judging by the amount of people taken to court over these riots. But what do you make of the police decision here?
Well, it's a fascinating decision, really, and one that you know we have to kind of sit with and digest for some time. But it is an unusual one. I mean, it opens up all kinds of questions about parenting. about accountability. I mean, I think a lot of us listening to this and reading about it would think that we would like to be those parents who have to kind of, you know, exercise tough love. I don't think there's much tougher love than actually taking your son, you know, to the place of accountability, the police station after criminality. But I think it opens up all kinds of other questions about safeguarding and about, you know, knowing where our kids are and having kind of boundaries at home and having good conversations, not only about what they do physically when they're out on the street, and, you know, obviously rioting is that, but how they respond to influence online, how vulnerable they are, how suggestible they are, and how, and what they're willing to do to keep friends with people who are perhaps not good for them, you know, in the long run. It opens up so many questions.
Well, yeah, I mean, any parent listening to this will know all about the pressures of peer pressure, because in that way your child can very soon have outside influences. Michael, is it automatically, if a child is rioting, is it automatically bad parenting? Because, your instinct is to say so, but then some parents will be pulling their hair out. They'll be doing everything they can and still their child will be willful and not listen to them. What's the issue here?
I think you know, we have to accept as parents and carers, those of us who are, that we are not the only parent, in inverted commas, to our kids. They're brought up by influences beyond ourselves, and that's not to say, well, we throw your hands up in the air and we've got nothing to do with it, but the fact is, and it's a normal part of growing up, isn't it, of evolution, that young people, 13, 14, 15, they start to seek their own tribe elsewhere. They want to make their friendships, they want to take risks, they want to do the kinds of things that we would perhaps rather they didn't do. I'm not talking about criminality, I'm just talking about, you know, not knowing where they are some of the time. And so some of these issues are ancient, about, you know, we can't keep kids under lock and key because it's not right for them and it's not fair and it's not just, and they will never develop. And you do have to take certain risks as young people to find out what life is about. But in terms of this very specific case about this 14-year-old lad, I don't know the ins and outs of the family. Obviously, I don't suppose any of us do. But they've done something which I think is unusual, and I think it is to be commended, assuming there's no backstory that I don't know about. But it's to be commended, because what they're doing is setting a marker and speaking publicly to other parents,
well, yeah,
who perhaps are not who are not there, or even join in with their kids. You know, we've seen some extraordinary stories about what happened with those riots.
What it does do, Michael. Sorry to cut down. Just conscious that the news is on the way, but that really interests me, what you've said there, because I'm interested to know if this will set, even if it's informal, will set a precedent, because other parents might step up now in similar incidents and say, no, I want the option of giving my child an absolute shellacking for what he's done, rather than criminalising him. And I suppose if this government are talking about, as they are, jailing less people or punishing less people, this could be a route out of it, actually giving parents the responsibility back to police their child's behaviour. Because I guess some parents, if their child has his collar felt at a riot, would just think, oh, well, that's it, he's in a course of justice and I can't intervene, whereas this shows you might be able to.
It's possible. Everything can be gamed, almost. So you could get a situation where the next set of parents think, okay, to avoid criminal, you know, ramifications, we'll give our son a good shellacking, as you put it. And if they perform well, it might be seen that, okay. And then you start thinking, are we not feeding into other problems here of, you know, underfunding of services, etc.? But once I've just come out of a meeting, a safeguarding meeting with 300 professionals around the country, literally 2 minutes ago. And we were looking at the fact that since 2010, 1,000 youth centres have shut in this country. 1,000 youth centres all across the country. How many hundreds of thousands of young people don't have that place. And let's assume that not all parents and carers have got the skills or the wherewithal or even the interest to look after and develop their young people and their kids. There are all these mentors, all these youth workers, all the people who've had skills and experience absolutely decimated. And that's got to be part of this wider conversation as well.
Yeah.
Because we do want parents and carers to be the prime source of ethics and guidance and your moral compass. But where that is not possible, we need others and a proper structure and to give really good positive activities, whether it's sporting, whether it's artistic, whether it's whatever it might be. And just to stop, if anybody's interested in the Youth Endowment Report recently, Youth Endowment Fund Report recently, 5,000 teenager-led interviews. One of the top five points was a trusted adult in your life makes a difference in terms of getting into criminality. So again, you know, are we funding that? Is it real? Are we got the right people doing that work? And positive activities do deter development into violence. So we kind of know it. It's not rocket science. We've known this for years, but we've just overseen this massive undercut of it. I'm not reducing it to simple stuff, but it's got to be part of the bigger conversation.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And I'm sure we'll be picking up the ears of a lot of parents listening to this. Michael, thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Michael Conroy. So look, it's interesting. What do you think of that? Just generally, let us know 85058. But I'm also interested as well is if you're a parent listening to this or a carer or a guardian, and you may have been in a pretty similar position where the authorities were cracking down perhaps on the behaviour of your child and you've intervened and said, no, I'll sort that. And what was the outcome? It doesn't just have to be the police. It can be education. It can be any kind of scenario. So if that strikes a chord with you, do tell us your stories, please. 85058 or WhatsApp us 0808 5909 693. It's Drive with Holly and Tony. Time for news and sport. Now it's just gone 5:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And at 5:30, let's get your BBC News headlines. Lebanon's health ministry says Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 270 people and injured more than 1,000. It is the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border since 2006. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says the choices she makes will be hard but fair ahead of her first budget next month. In her speech to Labour's conference in Liverpool, she also promised there'd be no return to austerity. Nurses in England have rejected the government's offered pay rise of 5.5% for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing says two-thirds voted against it in a record high turnout of around 145,000. And homes and roads have been flooded in parts of central and southern England after heavy rain today. It's also caused a sinkhole and washed away part of the pitch's surface at AFC Wimbledon Stadium. I'm not sure what you do when that happens, a sinkhole in the pitch. Yeah. Del, if maybe you have the answer.
Scary. I don't have the answer, but news on AFC Wimbledon.
It's a whole new
Newcastle coming up.
Whole new meaning to the phrase, play a bit deeper.
Well, absolutely, yes. Very, very deep.
Sinking a goal.
Might get the bends. The Friedkin Group say they look forward to providing stability to Everton and sharing their vision for the future. After agreeing to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club, the group, led by the American billionaire Dan Friedkin, had entered a period of exclusivity to negotiate a possible purchase back in June. Talks then fell through in July, but the deal has now been signed and is subject to Premier League approval. So who are the Friedkin Group? Here's BBC Radio Merseyside sports reporter Julia Bould.
They are headed up by Dan Friedkin. He is an American billionaire with a net worth of $7.6 billion. He also already owns Roma, but that's not a conflict of interest under Premier League rules. He's already signed that deal. The due diligence was also done in the summer when that period of exclusivity was in place. And I'm also told the finances are already in place for this takeover. So all it needs now is Premier League approval, which is an owners and directors test. And everything I'm hearing from inside the club and people around the Friedkin Group is saying that that should be done in a matter of weeks.
And there'll be more on the Everton takeover on the way shortly on Drive. Newcastle have announced within the last half an hour that they'll play their postponed League Cup tie against AFC Wimbledon at St James's Park next Tuesday. Wednesday, the 1st of October. Now, their third round meeting was initially due to be played at Wimbledon's Cherry Red Record Stadium tomorrow, but it's been called off due to extensive flooding of the River Wandle and surrounding areas. Leeds United have announced plans to modernise and improve Elland Road. Part of the proposal is to increase capacity from just over 37,500 to around 53,000. Glamorgan have won their second One Day Cup title in 4 years after beating Somerset by 15 runs in the final at Trent Bridge. Glamorgan made 186 for 7 in their shortened 20 overs thanks to an unbeaten 63 from Sam Northeast. Somerset managed just 171 for 6 in reply. It was a truncated final, reduced from 50 overs aside due to the forecast and after a washout yesterday. Here's player of the match, Glamorgan's Northeast.
I'm not sure, turning up today, we even thought that there was going to be a game on, and then it changed from 50 overs to 20 overs about 40 minutes before the start of the game, so we had to adapt. It was one of those where you just have to go out and play with your skills and, you know, try and adapt as best as possible, but and it just started raining, yeah, just as we came off, so someone was definitely looking down on us today for sure.
Elsewhere, England captain Heather Knight has been reprimanded and given a suspended £1,000 fine after a historical photograph of her in blackface emerged on social media. Knight, set to lead England at next month's T20 World Cup, says she's truly sorry for conduct that was deemed racist and discriminatory by Cricket Discipline Commission adjudicator Tim O'Gorman. However, O'Gorman accepted there was no racist or discriminatory intent by Knight, who was 21 when the image was taken at a sports-themed fancy dress party in 2012. That's the latest from BBC Sports.
And the latest travel. It's not doing too badly. You've got a lot of localised flooding out there. In terms of accidents and incidents, well, the M58 barrier repairs are underway, which is Merseyside. So it's eastbound, heading away from Switch Island, the M57, out towards Junction 1 at Kirby. The M8 in Glasgow, queuing eastbound at 23, the Ibrox Junction. Now, what's happening is it's broken down van, which has just been moved. So we're looking at the queues. They're left backing up to 26 at Hillington, but all lanes have reopened now. The M5 was closed in Gloucestershire at Junction 13, Stroud northbound. All lanes are open. Severe delay still left and through Cambridge and Whitminster as well along the A38. The M1 northbound and 14 to 15, there's a fallen tree. It's taking up two lanes from Milton Keynes to Northampton. A1M, one lane down for repairs near Welling at Junction 6 heading north, and the M1 northbound at Junction 5, that's at Watford. Repairs going on with one lane closed and queues, and the M2 in Kent. Westbound Junction 3 at Chatham, barrier repairs still underway there. One lane down, Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
Cheers, Orna. Thank you very much. Thanks to Delith as well for the sports news. Yeah, Holly and Tony with you on Drive. We'll have the latest from Lebanon in the next few moments, and we will bring you that update on the new owners of Everton. I'm sure Everton fans will be really interested in that. Just talking about that 14-year-old who wasn't prosecuted. Instead, it was left to his parents to discipline him. Such was the telling off he got for being involved in the Southport riots that the authorities decided to leave it there. Now, admittedly, that some of these texts that are coming in are anecdotal because we're going back in the day, but Nigel in Cambridge, for example, says we were talking about this at the weekend. In our day, and I'm talking about the 1970s, if we were thinking about getting up to no good, we'd be worried that the local police constable would march us home and therefore we would get a big telling off by our parents. That was as much a deterrent as the law.
Yeah, a lot of people, as you say, all very much anecdotal of the 70s and 80s. Someone saying they joined the police in 1982. And back then, parents regularly brought their children to the police station to be told off. It worked. But back then, people had respect for the police. Thanks for that, Tony.
When we went into panorama mode earlier on, Holly asked what's happened to the bamboo canes of the world.
Yeah, this is the things that keep me up at night.
Stephen Poole says, and this feeds into our back garden Olympics kind of theme. Mm-hmm. When we were kids, my mum dug baked bean cans into the corners of the front lawn and made little flags from bamboo canes, and we had an instant putting green.
Bamboo canes again.
Superb.
A huge part of our childhood. We didn't give them any credit up until now. Where have they gone?
James,
what pandas eat? Do pandas eat bamboo canes, or is I just made that up?
Yeah, well, is that the reason why they've all disappeared?
I don't think so.
There's only about 10 of them.
I was going to say, it's not a problem, too many pandas.
No, it's not, definitely not that.
Eating all our bamboo canes.
All the bamboo canes are in allotments supporting runner beans and peas, says Jane.
All of them?
All of them. So that's where they've gone.
Well, anyone knows where they are. And give us a definitive answer.
Bamboo cane watch. Have you seen one recently?
Where do you buy one?
Many questions. we're also talking about sporting events in your back garden. This one's Stevie Leeds. I used to spend hours in my back garden practicing cricket. I hung one of my mum's stockings from the washing line. What was in it? Something was in it. Anyway, and I used to hit the cricket ball. It often fell out of the stocking. You probably had it the wrong way up. And it landed in next door's greenhouse, says Steve.
These incidents could have been the start of some brilliant sporting careers.
Whether they meant the stockings were going to be the net. So that's what I was sort of picturing.
Are you asking what denier they were?
Potentially. Have to be 100, surely.
Impressed.
Is that a fine stocking?
No, 100 is the stronger the better, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, 100 is opaque.
Opaque?
Yeah, opaque.
Okay, thank you.
opaque, so that's the thick ones, isn't it? The 100. Yes. Yeah, I need to get them out for the winter time. Yeah. There you go.
What's fishnet? What denier's a fishnet?
I don't think it gets
I don't think it even gets a denier, no.
Oh, no. Get a denier.
Full of holes in it, isn't it?
There we go. Right.
What's denier's a fishnet?
Let us know at 505A.
Yeah. So it's what's out to all the bamboo canes in the world and what denier's a fishnet stocking. That's where we are at the moment on Dry. Right, Holly and Tony. And Holly's here all week, aren't you?
I am here all week, yes.
Good.
This is the standard that we will become accustomed to when I'm sat in this chair, I think.
I hate to say it, but we've peaked. It is Drive, and it is 5:39.
On BBC iPlayer.
I want to take you on tour. I want to take you to India.
Wow! Buzzing me.
I've never been anywhere like it.
Freddie Flintoff's Field of Dreams on tour.
We're representing England, but we're representing something far bigger than that. We're representing Preston.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Good evening. You are listening to Tony and Holly. It's just approaching 6:20. Lebanon's health ministry says Israeli airstrikes today are now known to have killed more than 270 people. It is the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border since 2006. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has urged civilians to take warnings to leave southern Lebanon seriously.
The IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
Now, we are getting updates on this story throughout the day. We have been hearing that the Pentagon is sending a small number of additional US troops to the Middle East amid this growing crisis. That's according to Pentagon spokesman Major General Pat Ryder. Also in the past hour, Israel has confirmed that one of the targets of its strikes in Beirut today was Ali Karaki. That is a senior Hezbollah commander. This after two other top commanders were both killed in Israeli strikes in recent weeks. Let's get the latest now from our correspondent, Daniel De Simone, who is in Jerusalem. Good evening, Daniel.
Evening.
I think what's notable here, it's the scale of these attacks, which are so significant, because up until now, this has been sort of contained to border areas between Israel and Lebanon. And now what we're looking at, this is much more widespread. What does this tell us?
Well, so the airstrikes today are definitely the most extensive that Israel has carried out in the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah that's been going on for nearly a year. It started the day after the October 7th attacks by Hamas, when Hezbollah fired rockets into Israel. And since then, we've seen constant exchanges of fire, Hezbollah rockets being fired in, drones being sent in, and Israel carrying out airstrikes. A week ago, we had Israel setting out a war goal, which was the return home of the 60,000 people in northern Israel displaced by this conflict. And since then, we've seen a really credible series, you know, a really very severe series of attacks against Hezbollah. We've seen airstrikes last week, targeted attacks on senior Hezbollah members, and of course, the pager and walkie-talkie explosions. Mm-hmm. And then today, Israel announcing this morning that it was going to be carrying out what it described as extensive airstrikes against what it called civilian infrastructure, meaning houses and homes, where it said Hezbollah has been storing and hiding weapons. And it then warned people in southern Lebanon and later in the day in the Bekaa Valley in northeast Lebanon to get out for their own safety. And it said, if you live near where weapons are being stored, you should leave. It didn't say where people should go. And it didn't say exactly where would be attacked, which villages, which towns. And that's led to a huge influx of people leaving, fleeing to other areas of Lebanon. And the Lebanese authorities, in their last update, saying at least 274 people have been killed in these strikes, with 21 of those described as children, and over 1,000 people injured. But at the moment, the Israeli government and military saying they're going to be carrying on these actions until they achieve their goal. Hezbollah, for its part, saying it's going to keep firing rockets because it won't stop until there's a ceasefire in Gaza.
Now, obviously, but both sides, we've heard that they've both described this as a new phase of this war. Both sides, of course, under huge pressure from global leaders not to escalate further. But after these attacks, including that airstrike that you mentioned on Friday and everything that's happened over the last few days, we get a sense that Hezbollah are defiant, but they haven't responded with all-out war. Why?
Well, that's Hezbollah certainly has been assessed as being more militarily capable than Hamas, that it's had a very, very large stockpile of missiles, rockets, and by the Israeli military's own admission, they could fire deep into Israel and target population centres, which until now, until really this week, it had been mainly firing to northern Israel. Yesterday, some of the rockets that were fired went further into Israel, deeper into Israel than previously in the previous year. But it has still not... Israel said yesterday and again today that it anticipated a much bigger attack from Hezbollah, and that sort of, according to the Israeli military, that precipitated some of its own actions in saying they were targeting rocket launchers and other things that were trying to stop an attack by Hezbollah. But certainly it's been the view that until really the past week, both sides have held a lot back and haven't gone into all-out war, because both knew that could be very devastating and very difficult for both, because Hezbollah could fire rockets into and missiles into Israel, and Israel might then get into a ground incursion where it's been into Lebanon before and got burnt, and it hasn't always come out with its goals achieved. But as things stand today, the goal of stopping Hezbollah rocket fire has not been achieved. It's still firing rockets. And that does then leave a question about what else might happen, whether the airstrikes that Israel have been carrying out will be enough to achieve the goal, or whether there might be something else yet that happens, and that something else is being speculated as a possible ground incursion. No word on that officially from the Israeli military, though.
Yeah, tell me about that, the significance of that. That's something that we've talked about in the past, but that would be a huge escalation by Israel.
It would be an escalation. It would be different to what we've seen until now. And I think there's a lot of speculation about whether Israel really wants to do that, given it's gone in before. Hezbollah, the leader of Hezbollah, saying last week, effectively saying, bring it on. You know, that if you want to come in, we'll fight you. And certainly there's been constant defiance from Hezbollah, saying that they will keep fighting, but also saying, which they've been saying all along, whether Israel believes them or not, that the reason they're doing this is, according to Hezbollah, out of solidarity with Palestinians, and that if there was a ceasefire in Gaza, then they would stop. And that has been, when you've seen world powers and the UN have been calling for a diplomatic resolution to this to stop both sides from going even further into this conflict, saying there's a way to stop this, there's a way to get a ceasefire and allow people on both sides of the border to return home. At the moment, that just doesn't seem likely as things stand tonight, because the Israeli government's saying they're going to carry on until they meet their goals, and they've set their goal, which is to get these people home in northern Israel, which is a very measurable goal. And they're saying that is going to be achieved by stopping Hezbollah firing rockets. You know, Hezbollah's saying they're not going to stop firing rockets. So they both can't be right.
Yeah.
Those positions can't really be resolved. And that means that until we get a resolution and we get some sort of finality, this is just, at the moment, this is spiraling and it's carrying on.
Our correspondent Daniel DeSimone in Jerusalem. Thank you for that update. Just that Lebanon's health ministry saying at least 274 people have been killed, more than 1,000 wounded in Israeli strikes today in what has been described as the deadliest day of the Israel-Hezbollah conflict since 2006. There's further reaction to that on the BBC News website. It is 5:47.
Now there are some new owners of Everton. The Friedkin Group, which already owns Roma in Italy, have reached an agreement to buy out Farhad Moshiri. We can get more from our football finance. Well, not ours. He does a lot of other things as well. He'll be thinking, that's news to me. I've joined the staff at Five Live. Kieran Maguire's here. Hello, Kieran.
Hi, Tony.
Hi. You've still got freedom to work for other outlets, mate. Just thought I'd let you know. Kieran, are they dancing in the streets of Liverpool at this news? Is it good news for Everton fans?
I think it gives a degree of clarity and certainty that Evertonians have been seeking for some time now. They've had a series of potential suitors who have effectively called off the deal or have been unable to progress the deal due to regulatory issues. The current owner has wanted out for a period of time. So the Friedkin Group, A, have significant funding. They're worth probably 5 to 6 billion. And they clearly have the desire now to take over Everton, which will be a welcome relief to everybody connected in the city and the club.
Yeah. And I'm going to mention the L word, Kieran, leverage. Are they using that? Or you say they're pretty minted. Are they wiping out the debt and just starting from scratch?
Well, Everton owe £600 million to three main parties, one of which is the Friedkin Group itself. So there's a fair chance that they might decide that they will write off that debt by converting it into shares. So that becomes less of an issue. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the other £400 million of debt. There's often what we refer to as a change of control clause when there's new owners coming into any business that existing lenders might insist on being repaid. And there is a bit of complication with regards to one of the lenders, 777 Partners, who appear to have been on the naughty step of some of the American authorities, and that might cause complications. But Friedkin Group clearly must be happy with the way that that's progressing.
Sometimes you just have to catch yourself short, don't you, Kieran? You say, you know, that Everton owes 600 million quid. I mean, staggering, isn't it?
It is, I think, when we all come from a generation of jumpers for goalposts. Yeah. And, I can still remember the first £100 a week footballer. The success of the Premier League has added a lot of zeros to the money coming in, the money going out and the debts in relation to clubs. But, the Friedkin Group will effectively be inheriting a magnificent new stadium in the city of Liverpool, which is going to be open for ideally Premier League football next season. And that will be a huge asset in terms of generating revenue and from an investment perspective as well.
Yeah. And just to end, Kieran, I mean, yeah, they've got to win a match first, I suppose. But I also, because of my team's experience, I think going down wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for them. It'd be a setback. But they could almost rebuild, I think. But anyway, what about FFP and all that, Kieran? So that these guys come in, they've got a bit of money to throw around. But as we've seen with Newcastle, it's not just that easy, is it?
That's you're exactly right, Tony. Whilst they have the cash physically available, ability to spend, given Everton's recent history with the profitability and sustainability rules, which limit spending, will be a complication. But at least they don't have the issue in terms of the existing owner, where players might have been a little bit wary about coming to Everton because they were uncertainty in terms of the direction of ownership. And now that we've got clarity, that one issue has been dealt with, and it's in a more positive position going into the January window than it was at the start of the day.
Kieran, good to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Anytime, Tony.
Thank you. Football finance expert Kieran Maguire with the latest on Everton there, 5:51.
I find that all very interesting, to be honest. And it's the American takeover, isn't it? What's going
another
on?
Another one.
Yeah, another one bites the dust. Anyway, coming up after 6 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to a campaigner. Really interesting story. They've launched a petition for the government to introduce tougher legislation to combat deepfakes online, something that has become a huge issue for so many people.
Yeah, we'll touch on the weather as well. There's been heavy rainfall across much of central and southern England. We said in the news, Wimbledon's football pitch, a sinkhole's appeared in one of the penalty areas there. Their match against Newcastle's called off. By the way, I've just seen it on the telly. It's just been announced that they will now play at Newcastle on the 1st of October, that game. So they're going to flip venues there. And there's a dramatic picture, if you have a look at it on the BBC News website, a part of the A421 in Bedford's become totally submerged in an underpass as well.
It's remarkable. You've also been getting in touch with the big news today, which is bamboo news and where on earth all the bamboo canes have gone. Turns out, apparently they're all at the garden centre. I'm just not looking hard enough, apparently. Also, they're in your gardens at home, propping up some tomato. Stephen Redland, he says, I've got some of them. Not all of them, he says. They're propping up my tomatoes. Yeah. Peter says, I reckon they went out of fashion. Oh, no, not reading that one. Right, okay.
Oh, hang on. Oh, a bit of blue. What's wrong with that one? I'll have to read that one.
Yes, appreciate whoever got in touch ending in 6954. Holly's obviously never been to a garden centre. Oh. I have. I didn't think that's where you got the bamboo canes. Okay.
Well, no. Well, it is. And can I read the one about the bearded dragon, or is that the one you stopped?
Oh, no, that one's fine.
Okay, I'll read that one on the other side, because we just want to... One of the other things you texted about, loads of you, about back garden sports, and that's because I spoke to David Lawrence earlier. He's won £1 million and built a crazy golf course in his back garden.
Started sort of 20-odd years ago. I used to take a group with learning disabilities to a parents' home in Goring, and they had a little... one hole golf course, putting course. And one guy in particular, Peter, he was normally very, very shy and sort of wouldn't really talk much. He would love, we'd do it twice a year. And it sticks in my mind. And then since then, I've done other charity fundraising. Sometimes we've used putting. And it just occurred to me when I was very fortunate a year ago, September the 16th, that this lovely back garden that I'm talking, you know, to you from, it would be conducive to three halls, which we've now set up. And it was wonderful on Tuesday. We had a various mixture of groups.
You've been very generous and opened it up. Just describe the course to us, because I can see a giant scaly tail. I don't know if that's an alligator or a dinosaur, David. What have you got on one of them?
Basically, yeah. Hall number one is the Pugsy Hall. I've been raising money for Pugsy. And that's with the coloured fencing going around in the colours of the spots on Pugsy Bear.
Right.
I've always supported that and had the privilege to meet Terry Wogan with a group in London probably 10, 12 years ago. What a lovely evening that was. So that's hall number one. Hall number two is the Jungle Hall. Yeah. I laugh because it is a giant-sized crocodile there.
Crocodile.
With, looking out at it now, and it's still obviously mind-blowingly brilliant.
Yeah, where do you get a 20-foot crocodile from?
Well, you can almost get anything these days on the internet. There's a range of things you can get. Now, my lovely the oldest granddaughter, when she heard what I was planning to do, she went, "Gaga, can you make sure you get a flamingo?" So again, Tony, I don't know whether you've got the picture. We've got a lovely, again, you know, full sight flamingo.
I've got a picture here of an alligator's tail, a flamingo, and a monkey pointing to the model of a bloke, the model of a bloke in a hat. Is that a waxwork?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, no, the monkey on... It's me.
Oh, right. Oh,
very
okay.
good. Very, no, no. very okay. good. Yeah, no, me with my hat on, which the wife said, because, you know, it was sunny, but also very windy, so I had to catch that hat a couple of times.
At your discretion, groups, charity groups can come and play it, can they, David?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first one took quite a lot of planning. I'm already planning the second one because, as I say, I've always... for 35 years raised for children in need. That's very close to my heart. It was fantastic.
It's a great thing you've done. Where are you in the garden now?
Yes.
Well, have you got a club with you? I mean, we should be playing.
Now, listen, Tony.
What?
We don't know each other. You're very welcome to come in. I'm going to tell you, right, nobody's been able to do hall number one. The alligator crocodile hall.
Well, have you not got a club and a ball there you could have a whack with now?
Of course.
Well, let's do it.
You want me?
I'm going to have the first ever game of radio golf, because what I'd like to do, David, is you hit two balls, one for me and one for you, and we'll see which one goes in the hole. So So let me just paint the picture then. So this is the, Debbie, this is the drive open, OK? One hole, winner takes all. Is it number two? Are we on the alligator hole?
Right. I am on hole number two.
Right.
I've got the massive crocodile staring at me. Right. I've got the monkey staring at me and also the flamingo.
I mean, sounds like my house. What?
Does it?
Right. So, look, who's going to go first, David, you or me?
Well, that's... Well, I... Shall I go first?
You go first.
Okay.
You go first. Okay. It's your course.
Right.
Okay. So, right, go on. Describe the shot as you're going to take it.
Right. It plays a little bit left to right, but the wife made this so much easier because the tail of the alligator comes round the back of the hole. So if you get the end of the tail, it guides the ball into the second hole. So it makes it a lot easier.
Right. Well, go on. Let's hear you go.
Okay. I'm going.
Here we go. Oh, I heard that. Yeah. Good shot.
Oh.
What's happened?
2 inches short.
Literally.
I mean, we're not being filmed, but
no.
I was a bit annoyed because I sort of...
Well, you've only got yourself to blame, David. Put it in the hole. Are you going to put it in the hole?
Well, okay, this one.
Yeah. No, you put your ball in the hole and then it's out the way of mine.
It's going. It's in the hole. It came off the foot, onto the tail, into the hole. Tony.
Is that my ball or yours?
Well, I was tempted to say it was mine, but I was 2 inches short, so that was your ball.
So I've got a hole in one.
You did. You did.
I'm thrilled.
A lot of people did, but it is a good hole.
Don't diminish my achievement.
You did get a hole in one.
So listen, what a pleasure that was, David. Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Tony. As I say, there'll be a lot of spin-offs in a good way because Tuesday was fantastic. Talking to the couple of parents earlier, they're just amazing. It's been a real joy. And there'll be many others because I love my sport and I love putting.
Well, I can tell by talking to you that you're a good man, David. So it's lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And you take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye-bye.
And bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye. David Lawrence, what a lovely fella. So he won $1 million on the lottery and he's built this crazy golf course in his back garden and he lets charities come along and play. It's fantastic. And as a result, you're telling us about your sporting adventures in your back garden throughout the programme. Keep those texts coming in, 85058.
Extremely varied. I have to say, I have never heard Crazy Golf on the radio before and I think I could get involved. Yeah.
You
just needed a little bit of Andrew Carter, or Catherine Downs commentary on it. And
there we go.
And we were absolutely flying. But keep them coming in.
This is only day one, you know, Holly. Imagine what tomorrow's going
to be. Oh, what live sport can we have then? I don't dare to think. We're coming up next to your BBC News headlines.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
It is 6 o'clock and here are your headlines. Lebanon's health minister says an intense Israeli bombardment has now killed more than 270 people, including 21 children. More than 1,000 people have been injured. It is the deadliest day in nearly a year of conflict across Israel's northern border. The Israeli military says it's hit 800 Hezbollah targets across southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. Tracy Chamoun is a former Lebanese ambassador to Jordan.
They're repeating exactly what they did in Gaza when they started to, you know, send warnings for people to evacuate from one area to the other area, and then they bombed that area as well. So they're not to be trusted in this matter, and they are definitely killing civilians in a very indiscriminate manner. You cannot separate the Hezbollah and the Shia from the Lebanese population.
The Pentagon says it's sending a small number of additional US troops to the Middle East. The USA has reiterated concerns over the potential for a wider regional conflict. Rachel Reeves has used her first Labour conference speech as Chancellor to rule out a return to austerity. She said tough decisions were needed to deal with the economic legacy left by the Conservative government. She also stood by her cuts to winter fuel payments. Rachel Taylor is a Labour MP.
We're under no illusion that there are quick fixes to the mess that we've been left with. We're determined that we've got a long-term plan, a decade of renewal. We've got huge, huge, exciting projects on the horizon.
Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds of its members had turned down the deal in a record-high turnout. Professor Nicola Ranger is General Secretary of the RCN.
That is not a significant enough pay rise to sort out the massive recruitment and retention challenge for nursing in the UK. And actually, we believe strongly in the diagnosis of the NHS that was recently shared and led by this government. We need to be part of the solution, and that's our aim.
And the US Justice Department says the man accused of a second assassination attempt against Donald Trump wrote a note saying he planned to kill the former president. The letter was...